sign up at lifenews.com. This has been Life News Radio.
The first and oldest Catholic radio station in the country, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, an Ave Maria radio station.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Welcome back, everybody, to another hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. And if you missed the first hour, I did mention, and I do want to start up by saying thank you to everybody who joined us over the last 3 days at our 25th anniversary celebration. Looking back over 25 years of Ave Maria Radio and Cresta in the Afternoon. And a lot of you came out. It was wonderful to see you all, despite the heat and the humidity. We all had a really great time. But as you can imagine, it was a lot of work, and the heat and the humidity took its toll after a few days. So Al's taking one more day just to get his thoughts together. We'll be back with you live tomorrow. Several great guests lined up. Teresa Tomeo joining us, looking at some different media stories. Monica Miller will be previewing the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Babies, and also we'll be continuing to talk about what's happening in Afghanistan. Also, a bit of news for you, if you did not already hear about Cardinal Raymond Burke. As promised, we're continuing to keep you posted on him. We are monitoring his family's Shrine website, where his family is posting all of their official updates. And several days ago, he left the ICU and was taken off of the ventilator and sent back to a regular room. He released a letter yesterday thanking the faithful for their prayers, and we'll have that letter posted for you at AveMariaRadio.net, or you can find it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. In this hour, how can an understanding of Islam help us understand our own faith? A lot of modern secular thinkers, in an effort to criticize religion and belief in God in general, will claim that all religions are essentially the same. And this, is, of course, is ridiculous, and you just have to look at what we say in the Catechism versus what other religions say in their various texts. And you can see, no, not all religions are the same. They all have very basic differences that set them apart. But understanding the similarities and differences is essential, both in strengthening our own faith and in achieving dialogue with others. David Pinault will be joining us in this interview, looking at Islam and its connections to Christianity. David's the author of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, and he's a professor of religious studies at Santa Clara University in California, where he directs the Arabic, Islamic, and Middle Eastern Studies programs. So we'll be looking at this, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, coming up after this news break.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, August 30th. It's the Feast of St. John Jagan. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. There's no word on when the city of New Orleans will be able to turn the lights back on.
I think we can answer that better once we have completed the assessment, or at least get further into the assessment.
Entergy New Orleans President and CEO Deanna Rodriguez says crews are using helicopters and drones to look at the power infrastructure hit by Ida. 2 million people in Louisiana are without power. And the White House says it could be weeks before everything is back up and running along the Gulf Coast. Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Biden continues to monitor this extremely large and powerful storm.
This will be a lengthy whole of government and whole of community response and recovery effort. And we are closely coordinating with state and local officials at every step of the way.
She added it's going to continue to inflict damage as it moves throughout the southeast. 5 rockets were fired at the Kabul airport in Afghanistan.
U.S. military forces successfully employed our force protection measures to thwart that attack.
In a related matter, Army Major General Hank Taylor acknowledging reports of civilian casualties during a U.S. airstrike on an imminent ISIS K threat near the airport. He said that's being investigated. Duke University is stepping it up a notch when it comes to coronavirus vaccine mandates.
the school is requiring its staff to have a COVID-19 vaccine or risk being fired. Officials say all faculty and staff must show documentation of their completed vaccination by October 1st. Reports show more than 91% of the more than 22,000 of the school's employees are already vaccinated. Those who do not comply are also not eligible for rehire. I'm Sarah Bartlett, NBC News Radio.
And I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
Good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. Joining us right now is Dr. David Fenault. He is author of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. He is also professor of religious studies at Santa Clara University, where he directs the Arabic, Islamic, and Middle Eastern Studies program. David has joined us before and brings a unique perspective to this whole discussion of Muslim-Christian relations and an intimate familiarity with Islam, as well as deep commitment to the faith. And the book is called The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. And, David, it's great to have you back here again. Thanks.
Thank you, Al. And it's really an honor to be back with you again and also with all your radio audience.
I want you to explain again the title of the book, because I think that helps orient us to your own experience and background.
Yes, thank you. So I should explain that the title of the book comes from a phrase in the Indonesian language in Southeast Asia, Sarambi Mecca, that is Mecca's front porch, which is actually a geographical reference. It refers to the Indonesian nickname for Aceh. That's a province located in the northern tip of the island of Sumatra, and it's that part of Indonesia that lies geographically closest to the Arabian Peninsula. And for centuries, Aceh has been the embarkation point, the jump-off point, for Southeast Asian Muslims sailing on the pilgrimage to Mecca. Now, Achenese Muslims pride themselves on their fervent Islamic devotion, and Aceh today is the only province in Indonesia that's governed by Sharia law. But Aceh also has a small Christian minority population that has experienced discrimination and sometimes violent persecution at the hands of the Muslim majority. Anyway, when I was doing field work there a few years ago, I attended Mass one morning in a Catholic church in Aceh's capital city, and I arrived shortly before Mass began, and I saw a procession making its way along the center aisle to the altar, priests, acolytes, and worshipers. And leading all of them was a young girl, and she was proudly holding high a crucifix, big in bronze. And that moment left a lasting visual impression on me. The sight of the cross bearing Christ's body being lovingly and even defiantly made visible right on Mecca's front porch as a Christian community persisted in its rituals of faith even in the midst of oppression and persecution. And that moment has been one of many in my own career in Islamic studies that has strengthened my own faith as a Catholic Christian.
And this, to see the crucified Christ within geographic proximity to a community that, in many ways, well, certainly to deny Christ's divinity, they also deny the crucifixion, don't they?
That's correct. You see, and that's part of what I hope to accomplish in writing this book. That is, I think the study of Islam can really help Christians be reminded of what is unique in the truth of its own faith. Yeah. Because on the one hand, Islam respects Jesus as a prophet, and it refers to him as a Muslim. But on the other hand, Islam and the Quran deny that Jesus is the Son of God. They deny that he's divine. They deny the fact that he was a member of the Trinity. And Islam also denies that Jesus was ever crucified. So these are fundamental differences.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the where the sources of the Quran and why Islam from its very beginning seems to have had a distorted understanding of both Judaism and Christianity. How do you account for that?
Well, a couple of things about the life of the Prophet Muhammad are very important to keep in mind. First of all, Muhammad grew up in a tradition that in Arabic is called the Jahiliya. Jahiliya literally means the age of ignorance, meaning the ignorance of Islam. It's a term that appears in the Quran itself, and the term Jahiliya refers to the pagan polytheistic religion, society, and values of the pre-Islamic Arabian Peninsula, where Muhammad grew up. He was dissatisfied with the tribalism, the violence between different clans, and the fact that each clan had loyalty to different deities. But in his own travels as a young man, and keep in mind that Muhammad grew up in his early adulthood, he was a traveling businessman, he was a merchant. In his travels, he encountered individual members of the Jewish and Christian community, because there was a minority population of Jews and Christians scattered in Arabia during the time Muhammad was growing up. Now, keep in mind that according to the Islamic sources, Muhammad himself was illiterate, so he was not reading a Bible. But he picked up impressions of Judaism and Christianity, and then interpreted them through the lens of his own understanding and his own beliefs. And I think that when it comes to understanding Muhammad's picture of Jesus, I think the most important thing to keep in mind with regard to how Muhammad understood Christ is the fact that Muhammad consistently viewed the life of Christ through the lens of his own, that is, Muhammad's personal experience. And Muhammad's life was one where he was rejected in his preaching, but ultimately Muhammad triumphed politically and militarily. And Muhammad interpreted the lives of other prophets, people that he viewed as prophets, through that lens. And I think that that's key to understanding Islam's rejection of the crucifixion of Christ, because the Quran itself states that Allah rescues his prophets, his messengers, the believers, and causes them to triumph in this world as well as in the next. And so saying that Christ was humiliated, suffered, appeared to be weak, any of those things, I think that that amounted to something that would have damaged Muhammad's self-image as a triumphant politician and conqueror.
But Christians, of course, see the crucifixion as the portal to the resurrection, so to speak, and which is ultimately triumphant, but they couldn't get there through the crucifixion.
Yeah. You see, one of the things that I emphasize in all the courses that I teach here at Santa Clara University and all the presentations I give, one of the things that I emphasize is the fact that the Quran never mentions Jesus in connection with suffering.
Interesting.
And that, again, points us to a key difference between Islam and Christianity, because whereas Islam tends to emphasize God's majesty, Allah's invulnerability, Allah's power, what we as Christians believe is in a God that is willing to make himself vulnerable through the incarnation. Yeah. That is, a God that is willing to take a chance. A God that loves us so much that he sends his own son into the world to go through all the risks and all the vulnerabilities that are associated with the human condition. And I cannot emphasize that enough, that, you know, what is unique in Christianity is knowing the fact that whatever difficulties we go through in life, and I think that you live long enough and you come to realize that suffering is part of this life here on earth, but whatever I go through, I can take consolation in the fact that I know that Christ has been there before me. He's been a pioneer in suffering before me. And whatever we go through, we're not alone in that, that Christ is by our side in suffering.
You know, this is, but from a Muslim's point of view then, a God who was vulnerable is a God who is weak and not worthy of adoration.
Well, exactly. In other words, from the Islamic point of view, the prophets are associated, you know, they're associated with being the bearer of God's message, and that message is construed as invincible. And so anything that is said or claimed about, we'll say, Christ crucified in weakness, as St. Paul reminds us, that would be seen as a kind of insult to the invulnerable majesty of Allah. So, and the idea of guarding the majestic reputation of Allah is something that's a very sensitive issue.
Okay, so then the cross becomes a real stumbling block for Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's central to our understanding of who Jesus is. The Muslims I've been familiar with have always been very respectful of Jesus. They have him, hold him in high esteem, but they regard our calling him God in human flesh is blasphemous. How do you go about speaking with Muslims about Jesus when, in fact, they affirm very positive things about him, but they fundamentally misunderstand his his identity?
Right, right. You see, in my experience, actually, in the whole realm of interfaith dialogue, when people from different religions come together to talk about belief, I have always found that it's much easier, for example, to have a conversation, say, with Buddhists, because there you don't have competing claims about
right.
the same figure.
Right, and, right.
Yeah, and it's much more sensitive when you have Christians and Muslims get together, as you can well imagine. Let me tell you, and I mentioned this in the book, in The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, here's one way that I would not want to go about it. I have seen so many times in interfaith gatherings that I have been pulled into, and I use that term because you can see that over the years I've become less enthusiastic about this, but too often what Christians have sometimes tried to do is to minimize the differences between Islam and Christianity out of a kind of goodwill hope of making sure that, you know, you don't have any bigotry, discrimination,
right.
etc. Well, of course, that's an admirable goal, but I think it's a completely wrong-headed way of going about
it.
I think it's much better in terms of how to talk to Muslims about Christ, to simply state frankly what it is we believe, what are the beliefs, and why is it that we hold these to be so important.
Hold it there, David. We'll be right back.
The Bench Pub in Livonia has remodeled and is fully sanitized for your safety. In addition to their famous burgers, the Bench Pub has award-winning chili and great-tasting wraps and salads. The Bench Pub offers drink specials and happy hour until 7. Several large screen TVs, free dart play and leagues, trivia nights and keno, you're sure to be entertained at the Bench Pub. The Bench Pub is located on 5 Mile west of Farmington Road in Livonia. Mention Ave Maria Radio for a 10% discount. That's the Bench Pub in Livonia.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
When their teens are struggling with depression, parents often wonder whether medication or therapy is the best way to help their kids heal. A new study published in the medical journal The Lancet shed some light on this question. In a randomized, placebo-controlled, double-blind study, the so-called gold standard in medical research, doctors found that psychotherapy alone helped depressed teens and young adults just as much as those receiving counseling and medication combined. The authors of the study suggest that psychotherapy, especially cognitive behavior therapy, which addresses unhealthy thinking patterns, should be the first line of treatment for teens and young adults, with antidepressants being used only as a support to therapy when necessary. The good news is that teen depression responds tremendously well to treatment, but it's important to make sure that your kids get the right kind of help. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shield.
Are you fully convinced that what God has promised He is able to do in your life and in your family? If you're not convinced, you need to ask God, increase my faith, help me to grow in faith. Brothers and sisters, it's essential. The world around us is becoming more topsy-turvy. It's lost its moorings. We're not anchored in the truth. So take a look. Take a look at yourself and say, where am I fuzzy in this area, or where am I definitely off track? You don't have to despair. You just need to say, all right, I see it. I'm going to turn to you, Lord, and ask that you would give me faith that I may see more clearly what's the right course to take. What are the right priorities to stand on? God is in Christ. His life, His death, His resurrection made your life eternally possible. It validates your life. You are worth something. No matter how deep of a sinner we are or how great of a sinner we are, if we hear the grace of God and respond to it and return, our life is infinitely valuable.
Sister Ann Shields gives you Food for the Journey, weekday mornings at 6:45 and again at 11:30 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Genthe Automotive Group is a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio. The Genthe Group of Chevrolet, Honda, and Honda Power Sports is pleased to serve the Ave Maria audience with outstanding sales and service for all of Metro Detroit. As we emerge from this difficult year, the Genthe family is committed to honest and professional support for all the transportation needs of your family. They're ready to serve you 24/7 when you Google G-E-N-T-H-E. May God bless all of you.
And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. David Pinault. He's the author of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. He's professor of religious studies at Santa Clara University, where he directs the Arabic, Islamic, and Middle Eastern Studies program, talking about interreligious dialogue with Muslims right now and the importance of not minimizing the profound difference that exists between the Catholic faith's understanding of Jesus and the Quran's understanding, or at least the Islamic understanding. So to what degree are there Quranic references that can help us in our conversation with Muslims? We start out by saying what we believe and why. Where does it go from there?
Well, I think from there, what I try to do in conversations with Muslims is to ask them to think about, okay, you know, what are the fundamental distinctions between people who consider themselves spiritual and people who do not? What are the fundamental differences between people who regard themselves, say, as religious and people who are atheist or skeptical? And I think that there's a very good discussion in a book by the Christian thinker John Macquarie, and what Macquarie talks about the fact that the fundamental question in the end is whether you consider the ground of existence, the source out of which all things come, whether you consider it to be indifferent to us or whether you consider it to be gracious. And when he uses the term gracious, what he means is a source of grace, a source of honor and blessing. Okay?
Yep.
And there, when you touch on that, I mentioned to Muslims, when you touch on that, what you've done is you've reached some common ground with Muslims in the sense that Muslims, Jews, Christians can all agree in the notion that not only does God exist, but God wishes us well. God is benevolent. And so every chapter except one in the Quran begins with an invocation of Allah as gracious and merciful.
Yes.
And so in that sense, there's a common ground.
Okay.
Then the question is, how does that grace manifest itself? Of course, a Muslim will say, that it primarily comes through Scripture and the Scripture-bearing prophets. And then what I try to point out is that for us Christians in general and Catholics in particular, okay, that exposure to God's grace comes not primarily through a Scripture, right, but through a person,
yeah,
okay, with all the richness of relationship that is implied by God's revelation in the form of a person, his divine son. And so when I'm trying to intrigue Muslims, that's what I'll emphasize, is the notion of a relationship with a person. It may not be something that will appeal to everyone, but again, What I'm doing is making it very clear what we as Catholic Christians believe in.
So the ultimate relationship that we can have to God in the Catholic faith is a relationship to God in the person of Christ. For them, it's the Quran, a body of propositions. So we emphasize revelation as a person that we relate to, and they're left with propositions. Is that right?
That's correct. And that also, by the way, explains something else, because as I often say to my students, you know, what you keep out the front door often comes flying in through the window. And so, you know, since people want relationship, in fact, and they're not satisfied simply with propositions,
mm-hmm.
I think that explains the fervent devotion that you see in so many parts of the Islamic world, the fervent devotion to the person of the Prophet Muhammad. That helps to explain, for example, the details of the current blasphemy law in the country of Pakistan, because there, according to Ordinance 295B/C, right, the penalty for dishonoring or questioning the Quran, okay, that's life imprisonment, but the penalty for questioning the honor of or dishonoring Muhammad is the death penalty.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Theologically, that may not make much sense, but emotionally, I think it helps to explain how, as I said, people want relationship with persons.
Well, there's an implicit recognition there that persons are to be more valued than propositions.
Well, you know, as a Catholic Christian, yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
It gets a little complicated in the Islamic world.
Yeah,
exactly.
This is fascinating. I want to come back to the crucifixion, though. How is the close of Christ's life presented in the Quran?
Yes, and this is one of the most fascinating riddles, really, and puzzles in Islamic theology, because what the Quran says about the crucifixion is that Jesus was not killed or crucified. It was made to appear so to the onlookers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And now here we get into what's called the docetic crucifixion. And I talk about this in some detail in the book. And basically what this means is that it looked as if Christ were crucified, but not really. And so there are two things to this, two aspects to keep in mind. One is that the notion of a docetic crucifixion is something that had appeared as a notion centuries before in what is known as Gnosticism. There was a subset of individuals who honored Christ but were repelled by the notion that Jesus could become fully human with all the weakness associated with that. They wanted a savior figure who would take us out of this world rather than a figure who would be fully involved with us in our sufferings in this world. And those are the Docetic Gnostics. That was essentially a heresy that existed as early as the second century. We know that that heresy persisted in the Near East right up through the time of the Prophet Muhammad. In other words, one of the things that I explore in the book is the fact that when Muhammad first began his preaching and had contact intermittently with Jews and Christians, there were two alternative Christologies circulating. One, what we would call the Orthodox, that Jesus truly was crucified, and the other, the Docetic. Muhammad went for choice B. And the interesting question is, why that alternative model of the crucifixion? And I think it goes back to what I said earlier, because the Quran insists that it looked as if he were truly crucified, but in fact wasn't. Okay, and that fits with the model of what I call Allah's 11th hour rescue of the prophets. In other words, Muhammad could not tolerate the thought of his predecessor, that is Jesus, whom Muhammad regarded as a fellow prophet and fellow Muslim. Muhammad couldn't tolerate the idea of Jesus being humiliated, okay, because of the fact that Muhammad saw things through the lens of worldly triumph.
Right, right.
And so that, I think that that affected everything really profoundly in terms of how the Quran depicts the crucifixion.
Now, what, just curious here, I came across group many years ago, and I know they're still around. I might get the pronunciation wrong, but the Ahmadiyyas?
Yeah, the Ahmadiyyas, yeah.
Ahmadiyyas. Don't they have a different understanding of the crucifixion than most Muslims?
Yes, they sure do. They go for what's called the swoon theory.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and just to recap this briefly, the Ahmadis, also known as the Ahmadiyya, so what the Ahmadis say is that Jesus was crucified, but he did not die on the cross. They claim that he swooned, that he was temporarily unconscious, but that while he was still alive, he was taken down from the cross, and his followers looked after him until Jesus was well enough to get up and about again. And they also claimed that he traveled subsequently on foot all the way to India.
Okay.
And they claim that he also preached in India, and he died and is buried in Kashmir. Keep in mind that the Ahmadis are a sect that is still active today. They were founded in the late 19th century in British India, I should mention,
by
British Indian Muslim. Okay. The other footnote to this I should mention is that the Ahmadis also claim that there can be prophets after Muhammad, and Mirza Ghulam Ahmed, that's the founder of the movement after whom the Ahmadis are named, Mirza Ghulam Ahmed himself claimed to be a prophet. And for that reason, especially, both Sunnis and Shias tend to reject the Ahmadis completely as non-Muslims.
Okay.
And the Ahmadis have been subjected to very violent persecution, actually.
Okay, okay. So, to what are they a player today? I mean, what's their relative strength in... Because they're very... My memory of them is that they were very big evangelizers or proclaimers, that they were big on converts.
That's right. That's right. In fact, they've been very active as missionaries, including in North America and the United States. The way that they tend to present themselves is to say that their primary message is one of peace, which is something that very few people are going to object to. It's what they tend not to emphasize, of course, so much are the profound differences between their own views and those of their, their Sunni and Shia neighbors. In countries like Indonesia and in Pakistan, they've been subject to intense harassment and having their mosques shut down or even burned. So on the one hand, they do a lot of evangelizing among non-Muslims. Within the Islamic world, they've suffered a lot of persecution.
Okay. David, can you stay with me another segment?
Absolutely.
Very good. My guest, Dr. David Fennell, the book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, it's a Christian companion's a Christian's companion for the study of Islam. We're trying to, again, try to get behind the eyes of Muslims and how they see the Catholic faith.
Old St. Mary's Roman Catholic Church in downtown Detroit, in Greektown, invites all to the monthly First Friday High Mass in the Tridentine form. Experience the authentic Catholic traditional Latin Mass, including the church's rich musical tradition of Gregorian chant and sacred polyphony. Please join us this Friday, September 3rd, at 7 p.m. Free and guarded parking are provided in the church's lot. For more details, visit oldstmarysdetroit.com.
Last week at AveMariaRadio.net's poll of the week, we wanted to know who you thought was responsible for the conflict in Afghanistan. 52% of you said President Biden in some capacity. 6% of you said the Taliban. 3% of you said President Barack Obama. And 1% of you said President Donald Trump. Check out our new poll now at AveMariaRadio.net. Just scroll down on the homepage and click Poll of the Week.
How can you really tame the tongue? Every time I read or am reminded of the scripture verse about being aware of being a teacher, because as teachers of the faith will be judged more harshly, I take a long pause and deep thought. That is the moment to really tame the tongue. We have to first know truth before we speak it. When we evangelize the faith, we have to know the faith regardless of the talents we're using to bring others to Christ. We can't bring others to someone we don't know ourselves. When I'm speaking on the radio or writing about Jesus, I speak to Him first. I read Scripture on most days. I focus the center of my life on Christ. I don't want my words to cause others to go astray. I will be held accountable for everything I say and don't say. We have to tame the tongue and communicate control over our messages. And if we want to truly tame that tongue, focus on what Jesus would say. Know what to speak of before you speak. This has been a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Denhagarmo, a communications evangelist and host of Epiphany.
Fire on the Earth, Peter Herbeck.
Sometimes now I just think when I hear people who are baptized and they face a hardship or something or a disappointment in life, they say, forget it, I'm done with God. I'm done with God. I prayed and I didn't want this thing to happen and it happened, so forget Him. And people walk away. Or there's sickness or there's disease and there's trial. Friends, we live in a fallen world. This is not the place where we're going to find our ultimate comfort and happiness. Jesus did not promise us comfort and security and safety and fun and a jacuzzi, a limo ride in Disney World. He didn't promise us this kind of comfort. He said, I will give you a kingdom and everything that belongs to me, but you must first become my disciple. You must repent of your sin, change your heart, change the thing you love more than God, throw your idols on the ground, and put God first in your life. Enter His church and then follow Him on the narrow way. And He said, be assured, if you want to follow me, it's going to cost you everything. And this is where the hostility of the world will come against you. Because the world hates me, Jesus said. It hates Him. He's the one threat that the devil can't handle in this world.
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on 990 Ave Maria Radio.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. David Fennell. The book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. You were mentioning earlier how what sometimes we deny at the door comes back to us through the window. And I'm thinking here of the Muslim rejection of the person of Christ and that sense of strong personal relationship with God. And I've often been surprised at some of the language of Muslim, more mystical writers and some Sufi writers, where they seem to be talking quite personally about God. And I'm wondering what does the Muslim Orthodoxy think of those kind of mystical writings?
Yes, well, that's been a point of considerable controversy. Okay, first of all, some basic definitions. When we're talking about the Sufis, we're talking about the mystical dimension of Islam. And by mysticism, what I mean here is that aspect of religion that has to do with an individual person's direct, immediate, and personal experience of God in this life without having to wait for the next life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only thing about mysticism is that because of the fact that it posits the possibility of this kind of direct encounter, personal encounter with God in this life, is that that can have a way of potentially sort of shortchanging or sidestepping or jumping around the ecclesiastical hierarchy.
Right.
And every world religion has some kind of authoritative hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Sufis in Islam have often been viewed with suspicion by the ulama, the religious scholars who are the guardians of the Orthodox tradition. And part of it has to do, again, with this sense that the Sufis are creating an alternate hierarchy. But then there's also theological suspicion of the Sufis as well, that is, if you read Sufi literature, very often the Sufis describe the encounter with God in terms of language that approaches what in Islamic theology is called ittihad. Ittihad means unification with God, becoming one with God. And that's absolutely unacceptable according to Islamic orthodoxy. And so the Sufis would sometimes claim, well, it's not ittihad, it's what they call ittisal. Ittisal means getting into contact with. And so you might say, well, that's just a difference of a word, but these terms can become very important. Okay, but what it all testifies to, you know, to me, is the hunger that all of us have as created beings to want to have a close, intimate relationship with our Creator, and that's what, you know, that's why I make that reference to, you know, if you keep something out in the front door, then, you know, it's going to tend to come in through the window, you know. And so, in other words, every religion in its own way is struggling to express a form of the truth. J.R.R. Tolkien, the author, of course, of, you know, Lord of the Rings, in his conversations with C.S. Lewis, conversations that helped the young C.S. Lewis become Christian, Tolkien talks about how, you know, we are instinctively storytellers. We are what Tolkien calls sub-creators. We are unconsciously imitating the true story told by God. And so when C.S. Lewis said that he was disturbed that there are so many myths in different mythologies around the world that seem to allude to the notion of someone dying and rising from the dead, and he says, so, you know, does this mean that it's all just a kind of pretty lie? And Tolkien says, no, because we instinctively are oriented towards the truth, and consciously or unconsciously, we're imitating the one great storyteller, and that's God. And I think that that has perhaps something to tell us with regard to the Sufis' instinct for wanting that personal relationship with the divine person.
Yeah, yeah. Would Sufis be more open to the idea of a personal relationship with Jesus?
Well, the interesting thing is, and I, you may remember, Al, that I have a chapter on this in my book, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch. Mm-hmm. In the chapter on Sufism, I explore how, in fact, for many centuries, not so much today for a variety of reasons, but for many centuries during the medieval period and also during the time of the Crusades, many Sufis were absolutely fascinated with the person of Jesus to a degree far beyond what you would have in Islam normally. Because in Islam, then and today, in Orthodox Islam, even though Jesus is respected as a prophet, you know, no one prays to Jesus, you know. Mm-hmm. Jesus is not the focus of devotion. But nonetheless, in the Middle Ages, for a number of centuries, the Sufis honored Jesus as a kind of model, that is, someone to imitate in life. And why is that? Because the Sufis said that Jesus lived like a dervish, that is, that Jesus was a homeless wanderer.
Okay? Yeah.
And if you know anything about Sufism, you may be aware of the fact that the Sufi fakirs, the dervishes, many of them were, you know, wandering holy people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and many Sufis would also not have families, they would not be married, and so they found Jesus, what they called the sunnah of Jesus, the lifestyle of Jesus, in some ways they found that easier to imitate than the sunnah of Muhammad, who, as you know, had a total of, you know, 13 wives and a military leader and all the rest of that.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So a very different kind of model.
Not really an ascetic, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Not in that sense.
When you look at the world today and Christian persecution going on, and your book does look at this about Christian survival in Egypt and Yemen and in Pakistan, do you ever foresee a time in Christian-Muslim relations where a Christian community could live in a Muslim-dominated society and have full liberty to preach the gospel, to make converts, you know, to worship?
Well, that's something to be desired, but I do not see the trends currently running in that direction.
No, neither do I.
In other words, the tendency has been, even under a relatively broad-minded and relatively tolerant Muslim society, the tendency has been, yes, to allow, say, a Christian minority population to exist, but only with the proviso that it keep a low profile and not preach the gospel.
Right.
And I think that the reason why the repression, the reason why the persecution directed against Christians has, if anything, been increasing, especially in countries such as Egypt and Indonesia and so forth, as I talk about in the book, the reason why has to do with the fact that Islam, like any world religion, is not just a personal commitment, it's collective identity.
Right.
And it's the collective identitarian dimension of Islam that is becoming emphasized more and more. In other words, contrary to what some people had fondly hoped, things like increased access to the internet, the computer, television, etc., that has not made us one happy world together.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what has happened is many, many communities around the world have felt threatened by the outside world, and they have felt threatened by modernity. And in the face of that, they're looking for one way to shout no in one unified voice to all those outside forces. And so for people in the Islamic world, Muslim identity, and especially Muslim identity in its visible markers, whether it's the hijab, veil, or the conspicuous beard, etc.,
mm-hmm.
that's been the way to do that. And so in any situation like that, the Christian minority population becomes seen as an internal threat to Muslim collective identity.
So Muslims can live in a secular society, but a Muslim-dominated society cannot permit Christians to live out their faith freely.
This is part of the great irony, isn't it?
Yeah.
That I have often encountered Muslims living in the United States who have told me privately how very grateful they are to be able to live in the United States where they can practice their Islamic faith freely. Some of them have said to me, back home, there'd be all these quarrels about which is the right form of Islam. I have met Shias, I've met Ismailis in this country, I have met Ahmadis, whom we talked about earlier this interview, all living in the United States and mentioning to me how if they were back home in a country like Pakistan, for example, trying to live as Ahmadis or Shias or Ismailis, they'd be persecuted. So they love living in the United States. And I've often said to the Muslims I talk to, I just wish there was some way to export some of that tolerance back to Muslim countries.
Yeah.
Because there's been a tremendous shortcoming.
The experience of Muslims in the West, do you ever think that would happen? That there's sufficient Muslim experience in the West where they, of pluralism, that you can imagine Muslim-dominated nations changing?
Well, that's a very good question. So here's something optimistic, first of all, that I can say, and that is that there are certainly open-minded Muslims who are trying to work out alternative ways of exploring what it means to be Muslim.
Yeah.
Those conversations are taking place in places like the United States, Canada, etc.
Right.
That's good. And the nice thing is they can do that without getting themselves killed.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's good. The only thing is, as I mentioned in the book, I've had the dubious distinction in Yemen, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, and so forth, of interviewing militantly minded Muslims in those countries. And what they have told me is they're aware of the conversations going on in the United States, and they say to me things like, you tell the Muslims back there in America that they've been corrupted by the decadence
right. That
is American democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's going to be a long struggle, and it's not clear at all how this is going to
end up. It doesn't look like it's anywhere in the DNA of Islam to permit that. But
well, see, that's part of the problem. That is part of the problem. So often, militantly minded Muslims have pointed out to me things from behavior from the Sunnah of Muhammad, from the behavior of Muhammad himself,
yep,
that they can use to justify their authoritarianism.
Yeah, exactly. David, thanks once again for all your help. Great talking with you.
As always, it's a pleasure, a real privilege. Thank you.
David Pinault is the author of The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch, a Christian's Companion for the Study of Islam. I recommend it to you. It's great.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. In the Bread of Life discourse documented in John chapter 6, Jesus states that he is the bread of life, and that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. The Jews were scandalized in verse 52. How can this man give us his flesh to eat? Jesus does not back down, but reiterates this teaching four more times over the next four verses. Many left in verse 66 because this teaching was truly difficult. But at no point does Jesus water down his teaching and call them back.
No, he allows them to leave, and even questions his 12 apostles if they too wish to leave. Jesus intended to be understood literally, and the Jews, apostles, and the Catholic Church absolutely take him at his word. Examining the truth of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Peace does not begin with presidents and prime ministers. It begins with you and me. What is peace? Where do I find peace? How can I be peace in this troubled world? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Please join me on A Place of Peace as we seek the answers to these timely and timeless questions.
A Place of Peace, Saturdays at 11 a.m. and Sundays at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
Joining us over the last 2 hours, if you'd like to learn more about today's guests, you can find Tom Holland's works and David Benault's works in the Cresta Guest Archives at AveMariaRadio.net, or check out their books in our online bookstore. While you're there at the website, check out our poll of the week, our featured articles, and a whole lot more. And also, always say, keep in mind, even though it's the middle of August and it's really hot, January will be here before we know it, and you can join us on our Good News Marriage Cruise. Stay tuned now for Catholic Answers Live. The whole team there is ready to take your questions. Later on tonight, it's The Journey Home with Marcus Grodi. And then tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon, we'll be sitting down with Teresa Tamayo, talking about the problem of confirmation bias in the media, and a whole lot more. And, of course, continuing to look at the tragedy in Afghanistan, we're keeping all the people there in our prayers. Have a great evening, and God bless.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
College football is back this fall. Hailing from sunny Southwest Florida, the Ave Maria Gyrenes will take on their Sun Division opponents for exciting and hard-hitting football. All games can be live-streamed by going to avemaria.edu and clicking on the live-stream football button. This Saturday, the Gyrenes battle Florida Memorial at 7 p.m. Tune in for great college football played by an authentic Catholic university. avemaria.edu.
This is Life News Radio. I'm Jim Anderson. Illinois is set to offer explicit, sexually charged school lessons in K through 12 education. Bipartisan criticism could not stop Governor Pritzker from signing the legislation into law late last week. Abortion will be taught as normal, and teaching consent to illicit sex will be sold to parents as a way to modernize sex ed. Two prominent Catholic bishops blast as a horrific civil rights violation a hospital for forcing a nurse into assisting in abortion. Kansas City Archbishop Joseph Nelman and New York's Archbishop Timothy Cardinal Dolan say the Biden administration has a duty to uphold the rights of the Vermont nurse. Contrary to laws passed by Congress, the White House, without comment, dropped a civil rights case against a Vermont hospital. The abortion industry, with dwindling numbers of healthcare professionals accepting abortion work, wants workers to be compelled into providing abortion. This is Life News Radio.
A culture of life is like a bright city on a hill. Just as people in 1890 might have had difficulty imagining today's cities, so it may be